Compliance Clarified, a podcast by Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence.
Hello and welcome to Compliance Clarified, a podcast for risk and compliance professionals brought to you by Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence. Each week, we discuss news stories and topical issues from our journalists and regulatory experts in the US, Europe, and Asia. I'm Rachel Wolcott, Senior Editor in London. Joining me today are my colleague Lindsay Rogerson, Senior Editor also in London, and our special guest, Anne Frank, Chief Executive of the Chartered Management Institute in London, a professional body for management and leadership, and has kindly joined us for this special episode of Compliance Clarified to mark International Women's Day 2024. It just so happens to be our 100th episode too. Hello, Lindsay and Anne.
Hello. Hello. So on today's episode, we're going to look at the backlash that's hit efforts to get women into the workplace and onto an equal footing. We'll focus on financial services, but this is an issue that reverberates throughout society. In financial services, there has been a backlash against ESG initiatives, and despite a lot of talk about diversity and inclusion, such efforts have stalled. Fear of ESG and D&I has been conflated into an anti-woke and in some places anti-women agenda, and with some politicians and pundits describing measures to tackle climate change and inequality as a societal risk. Equality initiatives are also some of the first to get cut when things get financially tough for businesses. A recent example of this is the cutting back of maternity leave to the statutory minimum by one of the UK's largest asset managers. And I have seen next to no pushback on this from the company's shareholders, perhaps reflecting the current political climate. And as you know, the Chartered Management Institute found that one in three male managers, 31%, think that too much effort is going into ensuring workplace gender bias. So against this backdrop, how do companies and financial services firms who want to take D&I or ESG forward stand up to this political and societal backlash?
Well, yes, thank you. And thank you for having me on your 100th podcast. Congratulations. So really, it's an unfortunate situation that what we're seeing is this whole area is becoming increasingly polarized. Now, you will be aware that the Supreme Court in the United States made a ruling that said that affirmative action programs were no longer permitted, that race could not be used, for example, as a factor in college admissions. And the spillover has really gone into the investor community, with many investors challenging some of the efforts of companies that go into this whole area. This is a real shame because obviously we know that successful inclusion programs boost not only employee engagement, but business results. That said, what are companies doing about this? Well, those that are, let's say, concerned about this backlash are even going so far as you mentioned, cutting their efforts back, changing the name of their efforts. So we don't call it anymore, for example, equality, diversity, and inclusion. We call it belonging efforts. So the DEI officer becomes the chief belonging officer. So we have some name changes going on. We have scaling back or removing money from such programs or canceling some of them. And you've seen in this country a lot of freedom of information requests saying, how much do you really spend on this training? And all of that is most unfortunate because, again, I go to my central point. What we also know is that when companies double down on these efforts, when they take them seriously and do true, authentic actions to improve the diversity and the belonging in their workforces, they get better business results. And this is true for everybody, men as well as women, irrespective of ethnicity. Diversity benefits everybody, and we shouldn't forget that.
And you mentioned there was a silver lining to the backlash, that a lot of these companies were just virtue signaling about their diversity and inclusion efforts around getting women into the workplace and into more senior roles. So the ones that were virtue signaling were the most likely to abandon these efforts. But you see this as a good thing. Can you explain to listeners why that is?
Absolutely, Rachel. We do see some silver linings, as you said. At CMI, we did a piece of research called the Everyone Economy, and we found what we call a say-do gap, which means that a lot of companies are claiming that they have inclusive environments when it comes to gender or race or disability. But then when you ask them, okay, you're claiming that perhaps on your website or in your annual report, but what are you actually doing? Can you name some concrete programs? And that's what we call the say-do gap, whereas 90% might claim that they're inclusive, for example, on gender. Less than half can name a concrete program that they're undertaking, whether that's sponsorship or a better parental leave. And that's concerning. Now, in this environment, the companies that were doing more virtue signaling are the first ones that are going to walk away. And in a way, that's no bad thing because they weren't really doing much. They were claiming without backing up their actions. The companies, however, that really believe in this because they do see it delivers better business results, better cultures, and increases their ability to attract and retain talent, those companies are doubling down on their efforts because they see this as a threat not only to society at large, but to their business. And the only way they can deal with that is to make even more progress. And that's the silver lining.
Yeah, we saw a lot of the say-do gap in some of the response to the UK Parliament's Treasury Committee sexism in the city work. That was one thing that was a real takeaway from that. But Liz, you wanted to ask a little more about that.
Yes. As Rachel just said, our UK Parliament is Treasury Committee has been working on this inquiry into sexism in the city. And some of its members, including the chair, Harriet Baldwin, have shared their past experience of working in the city and sexism that they experience personally. So it is something that's very close to the heart of the committee members. Their early findings are that misconduct in financial services is quite widespread. That could be discriminating against women, the gender pay gap, or serious sexual assault, which we have seen in the UK, come to light in the UK in the last 12 months. What can firms do about these issues, Anne? Particularly harassment and assault, so it doesn't turn into a legal minefield or a compliance exercise?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And again, we know from our own research that harassment in the workplace is still very widely experienced. Some research we did with the Fawcett Society in the UK showed that over 40% of women that were asked had either been themselves victim of this or had seen their colleagues experience this. So it's a really important issue. So what can you do is don't treat it like a compliance exercise. That might seem ironic for a compliance podcast, but this is really about behaviors and about culture. And what you're trying to do is create a genuine culture where people are not afraid to call these things out. They feel able to speak up when things are not right, and they don't feel that they will be penalized for doing so, because that is really the great inhibitor. Many women and others who experience harassment are afraid that if they do report it or speak about it, they will face retribution themselves in their career progress. And that is absolutely wrong. So when people think this is just all about compliance and it's legalistic, that's where you're unfortunately less likely to get progress. Our own research again shows that those compliance exercises are far less important in promoting real progress than treating this as a business and cultural issue. And when you have a business issue, what do? You take it seriously. Yes, of course, you measure it. You make sure that there's a plan. You follow up. There are accountabilities. Is that plan being implemented? And these are all things that actually genuinely contribute to progress in this area and take it away from being just a tick box.
So, Anne, what does it take to move the dial with women in financial services? Your research shows that women are still paid less, punished for being mothers and carers. Is the FCA's latest diversity inclusion and inclusion consultation and its non-financial misconduct work going to promote change? Like, what's it going to take, especially in this tense environment?
So I do think the FCA work is a step forward. They're recognizing that too little progress has been made, for example, since the Women in Financial Services, the Treasury's Financial Services Charter, was called into being. It was several years ago that was called into being. Over 700 firms signed up to it. And here we are several years later with very little real progress. So the FCA is right to challenge that. And I think that setting targets, we know that setting targets is a critical aspect of making progress in this area. And asking the firms not only to report the data, but to have plans, to have actual action plans. What are you going to do about this data? How are you going to improve it? Share with us those plans, please. I think the more accountability and transparency we get into this area, the more progress we will make. And obviously, action plans and measurement are both key factors of that. And those are some of the pillars of the FCA's new recommendations.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world, from the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, some of the firms have gotten this survey through now. Apparently, it's pretty long. I heard it's about 23 pages in total. Lots of granular questions, including about specific incidents of sexual harassment, the bullying, the there's another bucket of all other kind of financial misconduct. Also, they're asking about the use of NDAs to silence women, which is something that came up at Treasury Committee. I think it's also really important. But some of the feedback I'm hearing is that not all firms have this data that the FCA is asking for. And that it might be difficult for them to fill out this questionnaire. And there, like I said, there's also this everything else bucket that's in some firms, this case is prompting them to ask, you know, what else might non-financial misconduct be, maybe beyond harassment and bullying? Maybe it could be about discrimination or some other things that they haven't thought about so much yet. But I feel like maybe one of the findings the FCA is going to have that firms aren't tracking sexual harassment, bullying, discrimination, and the like. And it seems like instead of fines, the FCA needs to be naming names and holding firms accountable. The FCA's enforcement team this week says it wants to start naming names when opening enforcement investigations. You know, why not start with sexual harassment and bullying?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I want to give a concrete example of how naming names has really driven progress. We saw recently the launch of the latest FTSE Women Leaders Review. Now, that's a very, very evidence-based document. It basically ranks all of the FTSE 350 companies with regard to the percentage of women not only on their boards, but also the percentage of women on their executive committees and on the direct reports to those executive committees. Now, this names names and it ranks them. And so, you know, if you're in the top 10, great. But if you're in the bottom 10, you're going to be highlighted and your name is there for all to see. And if you refuse to fill out the questionnaire, you're also going to be highlighted. And on page 28 of this year's report are four companies that refused to take place in the survey. These were private companies. But the other point I would make is there's been excellent progress. And the FTSE Women Leaders Review, formerly the Hampton-Alexander Report, and the Davies Report, has been monitoring this for over a decade. And the progress is really quite astounding. So, for example, you know, if you're looking on the board progress, we now have over 40% of women on boards in the UK, 42.1%. And just 10 years ago, or just over 10 years ago, that was 11%. So this is huge progress. And it's all about transparency, ranking, sharing best practices, saying, well done, where credit is due, but equally giving a big nudge, big old nudge, where credit is not due because you're not doing much. So I would completely advocate naming names.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a place to start would be naming names that weren't properly tracking this kind of what's euphemistically called non-financial misconduct, which we really mean sexual harassment, bullying, discrimination, as well as some other things. That might be a place to start before they get into ranking, because I think they might have a problem being ranked as the workplace with the most sexual harassment. I mean, that would be pretty powerful, though. I mean, what do you think about that as a nudge?
Yes. Well, it's an interesting question because, of course, in the example I just gave, this is aggregated data that's not personal. It just says what percentage of your board is female, what percentage of your executive committee is female. But what it isn't doing is personal data and information isn't there. That said, you know, I think it's an interesting idea to explore which firms are experiencing the highest levels of fines, tribunals in this area, claims for things like harassment and bullying. And I do think that considering that is quite powerful as a driver of change. And again, which firms have the least experience of that? And you mentioned NDAs. And of course, one of the recommendations that's often come out is that they really should not be used to suppress this kind of experience. And they unfortunately still very often are. There are payments made, people sign things and agree never to talk about them. And that's unhealthy. Now, we've had cases where actually women have come forward a few years later and violated their NDA and said, no, actually, I am going to speak out. And we've seen that result in some powerful actions. So again, I think that transparency is a very important driver of progress, both positively on those firms that are really active in this area, as well as for the laggards, those that are refusing to engage.
Yeah, I think that people need that we're going to have to be creative about how this information that they collect is presented for maximum impact and continue to rethink that over time. But, you know, if managers, especially male managers, think that improving their company's gender balance is too much effort, I mean, that can translate into workplaces that are more vulnerable to the types of toxic behavior that we've witnessed already and we're trying to put behind us. How are minds changed? Do certain managers need to be managed out of a business?
So let me give you a couple of examples of things that can work in this area. The first point to remember is that it's extremely difficult to make progress in the area of gender equality without the active buy-in and involvement of men. And that starts with the men at the top. And the reality is, most male leaders are still men. I mean, ironically, the area of least progress in the otherwise very strong progress in the UK is in the CEO position. There are still too few female CEOs. This is obviously very true in financial services as well. But you've got to get men involved. So a couple of points there. Firstly, get men talking about this. Get them to understand it. I was again at an event yesterday where a male chief executive was saying that he really got all of his, he inherited an all-male executive board, and he got them talking about it. He got them reflecting on why it mattered. He led the business case thinking, we're doing this for our business to better reflect our customers, and because it's going to give us greater decision-making, more innovation, and more growth. But he did get their buy-in by allowing them to voice some of their concerns. Because the second point I want to make is that gender balance benefits everybody, not just women. And he himself said that in making the transition from an all-male executive board to a balanced executive board, which he has now, he called that a magical transformation. It made it so much more fun. He really enjoyed his job more. The men were more authentic. They felt that they didn't have to live up to some stereotype of what an alpha male is supposed to be. So that kind of inclusivity really benefits everybody. And this is especially true for younger men who perhaps, unlike their fathers, want to spend more time raising their families. And I know, for example, that one of you on this podcast has a husband that's just taken parental leave. Bravo. We need more loud parenting from men saying, yes, I'm going to stay home and look after the kids. Make it normalized. So those are some of the behavioral things that can positively encourage change. Now, there's also, that was the carrot, there is also the stick. And in this regard, one of the pioneers in this area is Paul Polman. He was one of the first FTSE chief executives to back gender balance at Unilever when he was there and achieve the 50-50 gender balance. And he explained to me, this is also in an interview for my book on this, which is Create a Gender Balanced Workplace. He said, look, I regard this as a business issue, and I hold my managers and leaders to account. And we have targets. And if they miss that target once, I say, okay, so what's going on? What do we need to do? Take a look again at how you're promoting people. Take a look at your pipeline. He said, but if they keep missing it, I regard it as the same issue as the head of health and safety in a factory. You know, if you're running a factory, you're responsible for the health and safety. If you have lots of health and safety instances on your watch, I'm going to have to exit you, because you're not doing your job. And ultimately, he said that was the same way he felt about people who, despite repeated encouragement, still didn't get it. They just needed to go. And that's what he did. So there's a carrot. It benefits everyone. It'll make work better and more fun for you. You'll be a better manager and leader yourself. But there's also a stick. If you don't make progress, maybe it's time to move on.
Oh, thanks, Anne. That's really interesting. And we will put a link to Anne's excellent book for those of you who want to learn a bit more and delve into gender balance workplaces a bit more in the show notes. I don't want to finish the podcast kind of by bringing things down, but I feel I have to mention something that I observed this morning covering a parliamentary committee hearing. You praised the FCA for the approach it was taking into calling out the gap between words and actions, or I quite liked your say and do gap. I think I'll adopt that one from now on in financial services firms on D&I. But this morning, just before we recorded this podcast, I was covering the House of Commons Home Affairs Committee hearing into fraud. But Steve Smart, co-executive director of enforcement at the FCA, was appearing, and he was actually asked, and I'm paraphrasing, but not by much. He was asked if the FCA's obsession with D&I was preventing it from dealing with the epidemic of fraud in the UK. Given that kind of hostility coming from our political leaders, it might be quite hard for the regulator to stay the course. And what advice do you have? Let's end on a positive note. What advice do you have on the FCA to encourage it to stay the course?
So I go back to my original point, and for that politician, if you're interested in growth and prosperity in this economy, you've got to be interested in diversity and inclusion. It's a key driver of growth and prosperity. And that's what the evidence says. So it's an incredibly short-sighted remark to say that the FCA should not be focused on this, because what they're trying to do is build a better, more prosperous, higher growth Britain in a core area for the economy, which is financial services. And better inclusion, better diversity, having financial institutions that reflect the communities they serve, that's a key driver of that. So stay the course, FCA, because it's a good thing to do for everybody. It will build a better Britain.
Wise words.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is a message that can not be heard often enough. But thank you so much, Anne, for joining us today and bringing your expertise and your research and wisdom to the podcast. It's been brilliant talking to you. For more information about Anne and her work at CMI, please see the show notes. I hope listeners found some inspiration and encouragement and maybe even some courage from this International Women's Day podcast to help focus on these issues in a meaningful way and push through this backlash moment. That's it for this week's Compliance Clarified. Your feedback is important to us, so please give us a rating on your podcasting platform of choice, or you can get in touch directly. Our contact details are in the show notes. For more information about regulatory intelligence, please search for Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence or check the show notes for a link. Goodbye.
Compliance Clarified, a podcast by Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence.